very few of us know them. They took an oath to protect us at home and abroad, so the rest of us can live safe and free. They are the men and women of our military and first responder communities, and these are their stories. American Warrior Radio is on the air.
Welcome to American Warrior Radio, ladies and gentlemen. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. A special shout out to Medicare Mentors for their support in helping to bring our Colorado Springs broadcast online. If you could use some help navigating painlessly through the Medicare system, check them out. MedicareMentorsLLC.org. That's MedicareMentorsLLC.org. Most of you have heard of the Battle of the Alamo, an iconic clash in which 180 defenders valiantly held off a siege by 4,000 or so Mexican troops for 13 days. If you follow military history at all, Kaesong might also ring a bell. This epic confrontation of the Vietnam War pitted 6,000 Marines against 20,000 or more communist North Vietnamese Army troops. Thankfully for those Marines, the outcome of that siege was different than the Alamo, but obviously not every one of them escaped unscathed. 274 U.S. personnel were killed and another 2,541 wounded. Vietnamese losses are estimated at approximately 5,550 killed, but as you know from Vietnam, those numbers are not always accurate. I use that Alamo reference because one of the veterans that's featured in the documentary we're going to talk about today was wearing a blue T-shirt emblazoned with the words "Kaesong Veteran" over an image of the Alamo. Ken Rogers was there, and along with his wife Betty, he wrote, produced, and directed a very, very powerful film called Bravo, Common Men, Uncommon Valor. In the film, 15 Marines and a Navy corpsman share their personal recollections of the battle, survival, and sacrifice that took place over those 77 days. Now, Marines are tough individuals. When you see them in this documentary, you will see them in a new light. You have to see this film. It will change you and your perspective. Now, if you don't take my word for it, joining us today is the voice of that story, Mr. Ken Rogers, United States Marine Corps retired. Ken, welcome to American Warrior Radio.
Thank you, sir. Glad to be on.
Well, I tell you, this is one of those shows where after watching the your documentary, man, powerful is not a powerful enough word, if that even makes sense.
Well, thank you very much for that. It's quite a story. You know, I was I got out of there sometime in, I think, around the 7th of April of 1968, and I got on a helicopter, and I flew over to the coast to a place called Dong Ha, and I got off that helicopter, and I looked back in the direction of Kaesong, and I could see the mountain range over there where it was, and I thought to myself, that's a hell of a story, man. And it, you know, took a long time for me to be able to tell that story. But once we got started, the people that are in the film, those men are amazing, and they were willing to basically tell the honest truth about what happened and what it was like to be in combat and what it's been like for them since then. And I think that that's why the film is really powerful.
Well, now, Ken, that's interesting. So you were already percolating the idea of the need to tell this story. It didn't come to you 10, 20 years later.
Oh, no, no, it was like, it was there, and it was, you just didn't talk about that kind of stuff. Nobody was, you know, it wasn't a popular war at that. By that time, it was already very unpopular, and people just didn't really want to talk about it. And one of the things I think that happens to people that are in combat is sometimes you don't know how to articulate what happened to you.
Mm-hmm.
So it takes a long time, I think, sometimes for people to be able to put into words the emotional power that being in combat has.
Well, you know, I never served, Ken, which is why I support those who do. But so often I get the sense, sir, that it's I did fight forest fires, and to be able to describe to someone what it's like to be in 10,000 acres ablaze, it's one of those things where you have to have been there. If you know it,
right,
you know it.
Right.
And I'm guessing,
sure,
combat is very similar to that.
Well, I think so. And I mean, it's like, it's not like you think it is. I mean, it's really frightening, and it's confusing, and it's chaotic. And, you know, after you come out of it, people, unless you've been there, you don't have any idea what's roiling inside of you.
Ken, let's back up just a little bit. Your path to the Marines, you're a sophomore in college, you're bored to death, and so you meticulously researched and were very careful about your decision to join the Corps. or maybe it didn't quite go that way?
No, no. So, I'm from your neck of the woods. I was raised in Casa Grande. I had a neighbor that lived across the street from me that had an issue with, he'd lost his driver's license, and he got his draft notice, and he said, take me to Phoenix. I want to join the Coast Guard. And I can't get up there, so I was not working that day. And it was in the summertime, August, late July or August of 66. So I said, sure, and I took him up there, and we went around to all the recruiters, and the last ones we went to were the Navy, and he went in there to talk to them, and I walked in to the door of the Marine Corps and joined up. When I left Casa Grande that morning, I don't think I had any inclination that I was going to be in the Marine Corps. I had not been drafted. I had not gotten my draft notice, but nevertheless, that's what I did. So.
And because maybe, was the Air Force office closed, or...?
No, he was just prodding around. I wasn't going to be in the Air Force. If I was going to be in, it was probably that was it. I had two uncles that were in the Marine Corps in World War II, and then I had three that were in the Korean War era. I had a cousin killed in Korea as a Marine, so there was some Marine Corps in my history. My dad was not happy about it. He was an Army guy. He was a top sergeant in the Army in the World War II. So he told me, his comment to me after he found out I joined up, he said, they're killing people over there, boy. Don't you know that?
Yeah, well, I was joking about the Air Force recruiter because I'm guessing while you're in the trenches of Khe Sanh, it might have crossed some guy's mind that, maybe the Air Force might not have been a bad choice. Now, Ken, you're a very interesting fellow, a Renaissance man, I guess. You have a Master's of Fine Arts from the University of San Francisco, an accounting degree from a small little teacher's college in Tempe, Arizona, whose name we won't mention.
Hold up there. So be careful what you say.
All right. You've been a sheep herder and an accountant. You've been a cattleman and a land developer. What inspired you to become a filmmaker?
Well, so there's this organization called the Khe Sanh Veterans, and it's all the guys that were at Khe Sanh get together once a year, and they have a reunion someplace. And my wife and I went to a reunion in 2009 in Denver, and there were a bunch of guys from Bravo Company, my company, Bravo Company, 1st Battalion, 26th Marine Regiment, were there, and we were sitting around telling stories. And she comes from a family that has a lot of veterans who've always felt it was important that the story of what they did is told. So she was telling me, we need to tell this story. And so I said, okay, yeah, you're probably right. And so then she thought about it and came up with the idea we ought to make a film. So we have no experience in filmmaking when she says this. And so me being a real smart guy, I know it's never going to happen, so I said, okay. And so we came home to Idaho, and she started digging around and talking to some filmmakers here. And then she talked to the Marine Corps Heritage Foundation, and they gave us some seed money to tell the story. And so we thought it was a lot of money, but it was just enough to hang ourselves. So we hired a videographer, and we went to the next reunion, and we got 10 people to interview, and then we came home, and we went on the road, and we were on our way to the National Archives and to work with the Marine Corps Historical Division to get some film and whatever resources we could locate. And on the way, we interviewed 5 more people. And so that's how it started. It was her, she prodded me. I had to give her the credit for it. And she's been, involved with it all the way. So
wonderful. Ladies and gentlemen, we're talking with Ken Rogers. He and his wife, I should have not missed that earlier on, have produced and directed, written just a very powerful documentary. It's called Bravo, Common Men, Uncommon Valor. You can find out more, visit bravotheproject.com. Ken, when we come back, I'd like you to sort of paint a mental picture for our listeners about the scene at Khe Sanh. And what you first and your fellow Marines and corpsmen witnessed when you first arrived. Ladies and gentlemen, this is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We'll be right back. Welcome back to American Warrior Radio, ladies and gentlemen. We're speaking with Ken Rogers, who had it, well, he and his wife had a big hand or really produced a very, very powerful film. It's called Bravo Common Men, Uncommon Valor. You can find out more, visit bravotheproject.com. Ken, I got to tell you, honestly, I had to watch your film in batches because it was so powerful. I had to take breaks. It was just, even after all these years, and, you know, I'm a young man who, I mean, gosh, I think I was probably in sixth grade during the Vietnam War, but it just really, really affected me. One of the recurring themes that came out that really struck me was the ages of the men, really boys, who fought this battle, yourself included.
Right. Well, I was one of the oldest guys in my platoon. I was 21. I had just turned 21 when the siege started, but there were a lot of 18-year-old guys there. The bulk of the guys were either 18 or 19, I think. A few 20 years old, and then me, and a case, you know, maybe the staff NCOs and the officers were older, although I was older than a couple of officers that were in our company during the siege. So it was just kids, man. So
now tell us, sort of paint a picture for us. You had the advantage of the visual medium in your film. We don't have that here in radio. But for a guy who uses words like palaver, I'm very confident that and maybe that Arizona State University degree too. I'll give you that. But okay, when one looks at the pictures and the maps, it's hard to get a real appreciation of the scene of this battle. So we're 14 miles south of the DMZ, 6 miles from the Laotian border. As I understand it, the camp itself was first built by the Special Forces to sort of monitor or interdict traffic along the Ho Chi Minh Trail. How large, when we talk about the encampment there, Ken, are we talking about acres, square miles?
Well, you know, it was like a big flat spot in a bowl surrounded by mountains. Okay, so that's what it was like. It was basically the main, I think, economic thing going on there was coffee plantations, which we knocked all of those down when we went in there, and they built an airstrip. And at the time when the siege began, I think it was about a mile long and a half mile wide. And then they, you know, brought in other units right a couple of days before the siege started. And so they expanded it a little bit, although a lot of them went out to surrounding high ground. And so they could, you know, Marine Corps doctrine, I think, is that you want to control the high ground. Although we couldn't control all of it, we controlled some of it. So it was triple canopy jungle, a lot of jungle grass, a lot of water, a lot of rain, a lot of mud, red mud, and a flat spot where the caisson combat base itself was.
Okay, and that's very helpful because I noticed there are some of these outposts, which all had numbers. As I understand it, Ken, the number basically defined that outpost's altitude. So outposts, say, 861, that'd be 861 meters above sea level?
Correct.
Now, the Marines that are manning those outposts, even before the battle started, was it a real distinct geographic separation from where the main body was, and did that get even more complex after the fighting began?
Right.
I mean, were they cut off really?
Right. 861 was like 2 miles from the combat base. 881 was farther. 950 was farther. And once they were up there, they were just up there, and the only way you could get in there was by helicopters. So.
Wow. Okay, so as I understand it, your Bravo did not arrive. You weren't there when the shooting started. Your group came in 1-2 days into the fighting?
No, we had been there since, we had been at Quezon since, I think, about the 2nd of May in 67. And I spent two stints on Hill 881. I spent one stint on Hill 861. We were at the combat base three different times, and we were on the combat base when the siege started. We were down in the eastern end of the combat base, which was where most of the nasty crap happened, due to the fact that there were ammo dumps there, mm-hmm, in close proximity, and all of the regimental and battalion headquarters business was there, and there were artillery batteries right behind us, and So it was, we were there. I mean, I was very familiar with the terrain and the country. I'd spent like a lot of time there humping the bush. So
now, Ken, was there, had there been some pot shots taken? Were there skirmishes, or did everything just kick off, you know, in a full rage?
Well, you know, the Battle of Quezon, as historians look at it now, was like a longer affair. It was like in three episodes. There were the hill fights, which were in the spring of 67, and then it got really quiet after that. And then right before the siege, some recon units got into some nasty little firefights, and then some of the Marines who were on 881 got into a nice nasty firefight. And this all occurred maybe 3 or 4 days before the siege began. So it was pretty much, it just jumped up on us. And you know, the Marine Corps had been telling us, get ready, something's going to happen. But they said that the whole time I was there. So it was kind of like the guy that cried wolf, you know, mm-hmm. You don't believe them. So
yeah,
they were right that time, though.
Yeah. Now, I tell you, one of the first, right off the bat in your documentary, there's some descriptions, and this is all first-person interviews supported by film and images, but there's some descriptions about the, let's just say, not-so-friendly welcome that Marines would get when they arrived there at the combat base on the airstrip. The planes didn't stop. I mean, they're kicking Marines out the back with their duffel bag while they're loading body bags, and, I mean, that plane just whipped around and took off right away.
Right. It was like you didn't, you know, I was fortunate. I never had that left. When I left on a helicopter and I was gone. But a lot of guys went on R&R or the new guys coming in, and the planes would not stop because if they stopped, they were going to get hit. And there were several periods of time during there that we didn't get any reinforcements because the airstrip was so damaged from incoming rocket and artillery fire that they were supplying us with airdrops. It was a nasty place, man. So.
Well, and I tell you, things got sporty real quick when some of their rockets or artillery lit off your ammo dumps. And next thing you know, you and your fellow Marines are not only dodging the bad guys' rounds, you're dodging your own rounds. And then there was something in the documentary, was it CS gas that was also stored there and that was released?
Right. And so we were really close to the ammo dump, like maybe 100 meters away. So when it went up, there were like 250 tons of ammo, I think, in that thing. And, you know, these big 6-inch rounds were cooking off and shooting straight up in the air, and then they're coming down and right on top of us. And it was that went on for hours. Then the gas went off, and you had to have your gas mask on because if you didn't, it was going to... It was like tear gas. I mean, we were going to be sicker than a dog. So the ammo dump had small arms ammo in it, but it also had big stuff and artillery rounds and rocket rounds and 106 recoilless rifle rounds. And so it was, then all of that stuff cooked off. I mean, it just all went up and it took hours for it to stop.
Now, okay, what do you do, or is there anything you can do in that instance? You just have to keep your head down until everything's done cooking off?
Yeah, we just got in our bunkers and hope one of them didn't come through the roof and detonate. And there were guys got hit. I mean, some guys got hit by that stuff. There was after we'd been, it was later in the morning, the platoon commander asked me to come down to his command post, and he asked me to go to looking for one of the other platoons because we'd lost radio contact with him and he wanted to go see if they were dead. They were closer to the ammo dump. So I went down there and there were guys laying in the trench. You know, they were alive, but they'd been hit by this stuff that was falling out of the sky and broken legs. And it was nasty, man. The trench was full of metal and scraps, unexploded rounds that had fallen and hadn't gone off. They just hit, you know, they may weigh 50, 60 pounds. You can imagine that falling out of the sky hitting you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow, carnage. So with the benefit of retrospect, do you think that those were lucky shots, or did they have you guys and the ammo dumps, did they have your command post pretty well mapped out, you think?
Yeah, I think they knew exactly what they were doing. They were good at what they did. You know, the North Vietnamese Army was, in my opinion, was a well-trained and a group that had a lot of esprit de corps. I mean, and their gunners were really good. So,
fair enough. Ken, when we come back, I want to talk a little bit about something that I hear, again, was a common theme in the film Bravo, Common Men, Uncommon Valor, and that's, we touched on a little bit, but there's just, no matter how good the Marine training is or any other branch, they just can't really prepare you for combat. And I want to talk about some of the more compelling scenes that exhibited that in the documentary. Ladies and gentlemen, this is your host, Ben Buehler-Garcia. We'll be right back with Ken Rogers. Welcome back to American Warrior Radio. Ladies and gentlemen, this is your host, Ben Buehler-Garcia. We're chatting with Ken Rogers. Ken and his wife have produced just an extremely powerful documentary. It's called Bravo, Common Men, Uncommon Valor. You can learn more at bravotheproject.com. Ken, I watched it via Amazon, Amazon Prime, but how else can people get their hands on your film?
Well, you can buy a DVD. That's basically buy the DVD or watch it on Amazon Prime. So they can find a link on our webpage if they're interested in buying a DVD, if anybody does that anymore. So.
Well, I tell you what, I'm going to, because, I mean, this is, like I said, Ken, it was difficult to watch, but it's one of those films where I feel like I'll be watching it several times. And coming back to the teaser before the break, to me, one of the most powerful points of the entire documentary were there were some scenes where the Marines and the corpsmen that you were interviewing, there was no talking. There was no words on the screen. It was just their faces, you know, paused, right. And maybe tearing up or getting choked up, and just some of the most powerful unspoken communication I've ever seen.
Well, you know, it's interesting how powerful the moments are like that you have in your life and how you don't ever get rid of them. Because, you know, we're talking about 40-some-odd years. When I interviewed these guys, like 42 years after the events that occurred. And it was raw and, you know, the wounds were fresh, just like they had happened the day before. Which you know, was one of the things that I had never noticed that I felt that way about it until I was interviewing these guys and watching this, and it became clear to me that I have the same reactions to the stuff that happened to me there.
So. Yeah, there are so many just wonderful quotes that I pulled out or really struck me throughout the interviews. And one of the Marines was talking about how people say, oh, you know, it's been 30, 40 years ago. Why can't you just get over it? And he says, I wish I could. Trust me. You know, I never want to forget these men that I fought with, but I wish I could get over it. Let's talk a little bit about, because, again, we're trying to paint this picture of how brutal all of this was. There were, if it weren't for the air and artillery support, things might have turned out differently. As I understand it, over 100,000 tons of bombs. Now, Ken, I'm a Wildcat. I went to U of A, so I don't do math in public. But that comes out to about 5 tons of bombs per enemy soldier?
Yeah.
That's a lot.
Yeah.
That's a ton, if you pardon the pun.
Yes, it is. So it was like, they dug a trench line basically all the way around our facility, so we could see them out there and they could see us, and we were shooting at them and they were shooting at us. And we would come in and drop bombs on them. And I remember more than one instance, we were watching it through binoculars where these North Vietnamese soldiers were in their trench line. You could see them moving around. And then one of our planes, our A-4s or Phantoms or Crusaders or Skyhawks or what all these planes were we were flying at the time would come in and drop a bomb right on top of where this guy was, and it would go off and the smoke would clear and the dust would clear and the guy would pop back up. I mean, so, we had huge B-52 raids that were so close to the combat base that we had to get underground because of the stuff flying around, clods and, you know, shrapnel, and the percussion shook the earth. And, oh, it was a nasty place, man.
Well, I tell you, one of the the still images that really struck me. It's a black and white photo, and you've got some Marines standing up outside of their trench, looking across a barbed wire at an explosion. I couldn't tell. I'm guessing it was probably artillery, but they weren't very far away. I mean, it was close enough where I'm thinking, guys, you know, get your heads down. And some of these strikes were, what, within a couple hundred feet of your positions?
No, not that quite that close, but, you know, we could see them. I mean, with, you know, a couple of hundred yards. But, you know, they had snipers that were killing our guys. They were shooting at us. You know, we were shooting at them. We'd get up on top of our bunkers, and we'd have, at night, we'd have starlight scopes on an M14, which we were not using at the time. We'd lay up there and watch their trench line with those, to those starlight scopes, and we'd shoot at them. We could see them. I mean, they could see us.
Yeah, just to give folks some perspective, and I got this off the interweb scan, so who knows if it's accurate or not, but it estimated that a B-52 can destroy an area 1 mile long and a quarter mile wide. That's a pretty big swath, and it just sort of speaks to, I don't know if it's the resilience or the luck or what was going on with your enemies there, but, I mean, that's some crazy sporty stuff.
Well, it is, and it's, you know, the part of the issue with all of that was, you know, that sometimes there'd be 20 of those planes come at a time, and they had put a bunch of devices out there, the Americans, we had put a bunch of devices out there that evidently triggered radio signals when motion came around. And so I think they actually trapped a lot of moving units in those B-52 raids, and you couldn't hear it. I mean, you can't hear those bombs until they hit, because they're moving faster than the speed of sound, I believe. So you don't hear them falling. And, you know, I think we obliterated a large units. I mean, they were resilient, and once they dug their holes, they were in them. But if they were moving around and they triggered those devices, then there were always planes circling around waiting for opportunities, and they'd drop in, and some of them would be these big flights of B-52s.
Now, I think, Ken, that might have been the first time we actually employed that technology, the listening devices or the motion trigger sensors. I'm curious, you had aircraft coming in, you Air Force pilots, Navy pilots, Marine pilots. I would guess that if I'm a Marine pilot and I know I'm saving lives of fellow Marines on the ground, that mission maybe takes a higher, well, I got a different feel in the cockpit. Have you ever had a chance to talk to any Marine pilots who were flying cover for you there?
Yeah, but I've also talked to Navy pilots and Air Force pilots, and they were all, you know, I mean, we always felt that the Marine Corps pilots were better, but, you know, that may just be inter-service rivalry BS. You know, a lot of these pilots would come in, and, I mean, they get right down on the treetops. And, you know, and they were all, they weren't Navy, just Navy or Marine or Air Force. Some of them didn't get down low. They'd stay up and, you know, miss, and miss whatever they were dropping at. But I don't think that, I think it just depended on the individual.
Mm-hmm. Okay. There was also a scene, one of the gentlemen that you interviewed talking about the experience there mentioned about, so the enemy is also, I mean, this is not a straight-up cavalry charge, as I understand it. There's lots of other squirrely things going on, and there's a quote, something about you. They were so close, you could hear the enemy if you're down in your trench line and you put a stethoscope up against the side of your trench, you could hear them tunneling. I mean, they were that close.
Well, and the fear was that they were trying to mine under us and, you know, pack it with explosives and then blow us all up, and that was the concern. And yeah, you could hear them digging, and it could have been they were just digging out there where they were, or they could have been trying to mine us. So,
what was there ever? Was there any place or any time that was safe, Ken?
No. You know, there were guys that were killed in bunkers that were so well built that, you know, you would imagine nothing could destroy them, but the North Vietnamese would put a fuse on the round so that it didn't detonate when it impacted. It would detonate after it penetrated whatever it was going through. So it may go in 10 or 15 feet before it go off. So
there,
It wasn't safe.
So it just, if it's your time, it's your time, maybe, huh?
That was where it became apparent to me that sometimes you just have to be lucky.
Well, and tell our listeners, Ken, the story about, you say the click of a camera saved your life.
Well, saved my mind, I think.
Okay.
I was, we were taking a lot of incoming and down around our position. I mean, they were really pounding us. And I was sitting in the bunker by myself, and it was like, it was really frightening. I mean, every time you could hear them coming in, you could hear those, they were shooting artillery rounds at us from over in Laos. And they were like big, 152 millimeter rounds, and they sounded like freight trains. And you could hear them coming, and then they'd hit, and they were hitting all around where I was. And, it, you know, I was just scared the hell out of me, man. And I was sitting there, and I started imagining somehow that I was outside myself, and I was watching myself. And part of that experience was that it became apparent to me that I was in one of these positions where I was about to lose control of who I was. I could mentally, I could look one way and see that that was insanity. That if I went in there, it was dark. And if I went in there, I wasn't coming back. And over on the other side was sanity, but I didn't like that because it was scaring the hell out of me. And so there was a guy who died on a flight coming back into Quezon, who was an independent film guy named Robert Ellison, and he snuck up on me and took, he was out in the trench, this crazy guy, but he was like that. He took a picture of me, or he took several pictures of me, and I heard the click of the camera, so I came out of that space I was in mentally, and I looked at him, and then it was like, oh, okay. So.
Wow. Wow. Ladies and gentlemen, this is your host, Ben Buehler-Garcia. We're talking with Ken Rogers about his experience at the Siege of Quezon. He's got just a tremendous documentary called Bravo, Common Men, Uncommon Valor. When we come back, Ben's going to get his dumb question of the show. Ken, I want to ask you about patrols. Why and how? Stick around. We'll be right back. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This is your host, Ben Buehler-Garcia. We're talking about the 77-day siege of Quezon during the Vietnam War. Ken Rogers was there, and he has, on film, just produced a powerful, powerful medium for some of the other Marines, and I think just one Navy corpsman, Ken, if I'm not mistaken, to tell their stories and their experiences there. You can find out more at bravotheproject.com. Ken, it's sort of an American Warrior Radio tradition that I get at least one dumb question per show, and there are, there's some chapters in your film, February 25, the Ghost Patrol, and March 30th, Payback. I want to talk maybe more about the Ghost Patrol. If you're up there and you're in your bunkers and in your trenches, what, this is really, really dumb question, but what is the strategic and tactical purpose to leave that cover to go out on patrols?
Well, you know, for the first month there, we ran patrols. I mean, because they weren't up that close. They were out there and there were firefights going on, but, you know, we wanted to see where they were. You want to assess the situation. And in the case of the Ghost Patrol, somebody from our company, I don't remember which, but platoon had been out there where those guys were a couple of days before, and there was nothing going on. So, I mean, that's what you do. I mean, you go out and you find out where the enemy is in terms of reconning his movement, or, you know, what he's up to. But also you're supposed to go out and kill these guys. So that's your job.
Okay, fair enough. A very direct answer. I'd expect that from a Marine. The a little bit about the aftermath. Ken, both, you know, you touched a little bit on the, in the documentary, but it's something we followed talking to other veterans from that era. And I just want to read a quote from one of the folks you interviewed. He said, "You just don't know what it's like to see a 19-year-old kid lay down on his belly in the mud and stick his rifle in that direction, give you the thumbs up and tell you to go in that direction. And he knows damn good well he is never going to get up out of that mud. He knows he's dying for you." The
right.
The survivor's guilt, is that something of let's just talk about the veterans that you interviewed and yourself maybe, something that runs a common denominator when you survive something like that?
I think so. I think, you know, it's like I was never so glad to get out of Quezon. You can't imagine how glad I was. And then for months after that, I was worried about on some subliminal level that was eating at me as I wasn't there with those guys putting up with all the crap they did, because even though the siege was over, they were fighting all over I Corps all summer long and into the fall. And I, you know, and depending on who you were and what happened to you, I think it could be a lot stronger than I ever experienced it. Obviously, some of those guys in the film were very moved about, you know, some of those guys on the Ghost Patrol survived the Ghost Patrol. It just eats out. They're eating them alive right now, I guarantee you. So,
one of the biggest tragedies of this whole occurrence, from my perspective and probably from yours as well, allegedly, President Johnston, General Westmoreland had even considered the use of tactical nuclear weapons during this siege. I mean, it was that serious and supposedly that important. But after the siege was lifted and your relief marched in, the base was abandoned. And
it took a little while. They abandoned it basically in late July, but I don't think they had any intention of keeping it. And if you were there and went through that, then that was hard to take, man. You know, what are we doing this for? I think now that years have passed away and I've done some research on it, I think that one of the problems in Vietnam is we never really had enough people to do the job we did. So holding that was eating up resources that they thought they needed to use someplace else. But it was hard to take.
Sure, especially if you had given limbs or had seen your fellow Marines give their lives to hold this thing that's you've been told is of strategic value, and then at the end of the day, well, maybe not. I can imagine.
Well, I was sitting. when I got back from Vietnam, I came home and I went on leave, and then I went to Camp Pendleton, and I was there for a couple of months, and then they transferred me to San Diego, but they gave me another leave, and I came home again, and I was sitting in my parents' kitchen in Casa Grande, reading a paper one morning, and I read that in the Arizona Republic. I'm sorry, we didn't get the Daily Star or whatever the name of that paper was down there.
Touche.
Yeah, but it was like somebody kicked me in the stomach. You know, it was devastating to me that all of those guys died, and not just us. I mean, all those Vietnamese guys died, and it was over this piece of property that all of a sudden isn't worth holding on to. That was really hard to take.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up, because we did have our South Vietnamese allies were also there, as I understand it, and they were given blood and sweat and lead.
Well, and they were good. I mean, they got, you know, a lot of South Vietnamese troops over the 50 years since that war's been over have been denigrated. Those guys that were there with us were really good. So,
Ken, let's talk a little bit about that, the aftermath coming home, because, again, just some amazing quotes that really, really struck to my heart and my gut. You know, one of the gentlemen you interviewed said, I was a closet vet for 15 years. He didn't come out. He didn't talk about it. Another, with tears in his eyes, said, I just want this country to love me as much as I love it. The reception that you and your fellow veterans got, do you think that now, looking back, or other peers of your generation at that time has improved, or have people just forgotten about it and moved on?
No, I think that it's improved. You know, people are telling me all the time that they, you know, appreciate what I did. You know, it was like my experience with it was more like people didn't want to talk about it. I mean, I got attacked twice, personally, verbally attacked by people who were World War II veterans. That told us we couldn't whip anybody, or we weren't worth our, you know, I'm not going to repeat what they said, but it was like, I wanted to whip them.
Yeah.
So anyway, but I didn't. So I mean, at some point in time, I just stopped talking about it because nobody was interested. So I worked with people for years that never knew that I had ever been in the Marine Corps, that I'd ever been to Vietnam. We never talked about it. You didn't talk about it. I mean, nobody, not nobody, but the majority of the people in the United States, I think by 1970, were just sick of it, man. It was like, it was not going anywhere. We weren't getting anywhere, and people were just dying. So let's don't talk about it.
Was it your experience with making the film eventually that as time passes, and unfortunately the reality is as your generation is beginning to pass, that folks are finally opening up and are a little bit more comfortable talking about it, Ken?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, I suspect that the majority of those guys in that film, if I'd have tried to make this film in 1980, wouldn't have talked.
Okay. Okay.
I don't think they would have.
Yeah, and I've heard that from other veterans of your era. Ken, we're running out of time here. At the end of the day, this is about the messages that you want our listeners to hear. You, in the close of the documentary, you had some very powerful words about that you're thinking back on it and just the reoccurrence of this over centuries. And it just goes on and on. We send young people off. They die. They kill people. They come home. What is your sense? Let me get your perspective. Do you still feel that we, as U.S., have a duty to stand up against oppression, but is it one of those things where, darn it, if we're going to fight a war, let's fight it to win?
Well, yeah, I think, you know, the tragedy to me is that all these young guys have gone off to Iraq and Afghanistan, and, you know, I don't think anything was solved. And it was like, I don't think the problem was solved, and I don't think that war is ever going to stop, because that's what we do. I mean, that's how we solve problems as large groups of people. You know, we instead of trying to hash out how you're going to fix it, it's just easier to go shoot some people. And sometimes you're attacked and you have to defend yourself. I don't have a problem with that. But, you know, I think the message that at this point in time in my life and with where I'm at now with this story is the thing that I want people to know is war is something we do. But when we send these guys and these women off to fight in these conflicts, we need to be prepared to understand the burden that comes home with them.
Amen. Well spoken. Well spoken. Ken Rogers, thank you so much. God bless you and your life for producing this documentary. Again, folks, Bravo Common Men, Uncommon Valor. Visit bravotheproject.com. Buy the DVD. Watch this film. Honestly, it's going to change your perspective. Visit us on Facebook.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ken. Over 100 podcasts, AmericanWarriorRadio.com. Until next time, ladies and gentlemen, all policies and procedures are to remain in place.
You've been listening to American Warrior Radio. You can hear over 150 episodes of this program at AmericanWarriorRadio.com.